This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, an Australian landmark and a sacred site. As the closure of the climate Uluru looms, we'll hear from the Minister for Indigenous Australians, Ken Wyatt.
I understand there are people who want about to put it on their bucket list. It would be equivalent to having a rush of people climbing over the Australian War Memorial, if I can be so brazen in that regard.
And air alerts residents in the New South Wales Hunter Valley vent their frustrations about pollution.
That's unbelievable, the dust.
It's absolutely shocking.
We can't live with it anymore.
As you might know, today is the last day people will be climbing Uluru. It's a significant time because it's also 34 years since the rock was handed back to its traditional owners. In the lead-up to the closure, tourists hoping to scale Uluru one last time have rushed to the Red Centre, and that's frustrated traditional owners who say they just want to get on with the job of running their national park. Oliver Gordon reports from Uluru.
The rush to beat the ban on climbing Uluru has continued right to the end.
We came to Uluru because my partner and my kids wanted to climb the rock before they close it down.
Even in these final hours, some visitors are still perplexed that by tonight, the last climber will have descended this World Heritage icon.
So it's not like there's an ancient burial ground or a ceremonial area. It's just a landmark that's in the national park, and I understand they own it and it's their national park and everything, but to let us do everything else and not do the climb just doesn't add up.
The closure of the climb is something traditional owners have long fought for, and in the past few mornings, hundreds of people have been at the rock at 7 in the morning, hoping to clamber up this steep red sandstone one last time. For traditional owner Leroy Lester, it's all getting a bit much.
Yeah, that's a clash of cultures right there. Can't blame them, that Anglo-Saxon way.
And he says more education is needed so that tourists understand the reasons the rock is being closed.
That's what's needed, because a lot of people aren't educated on Aboriginal cultures. You can tell it by the number of climbers, and that's a good indicator. People that need the education, you know.
Uluru is a sacred site and of great spiritual significance to Aboriginal people. But the Anangu man says there are other reasons to close the climb.
We're damaging the rock climbing up and down. Snail trail, smooth as marble, and very dangerous when they spill water balls up top. That water runs straight down to the bottom, and everyone slips over.
But after today, Uluru Park Manager Mike Misso says anyone who chooses to climb will be in trouble.
Under the EPBC Act regulations, or Environment Protection Biodiversity Conservation Act, we can issue fines or infringement notices for people who climb up, and then that can scale to actually taking people to court for if they're illegally climbing Uluru.
Soon, all evidence climbing was ever allowed will be removed, including the white chain that snakes up the rock.
We think it'll take about 4 weeks to remove it.
Tomorrow marks 34 years since the land title to Uluru and the surrounding area was handed back to the Anangu. Traditional owner Leroy Lester, whose dad stood next to the Governor-General that day, has no doubt this next chapter in Uluru's history is one his father would be happy about.
Yeah, probably, you know, from what I think, long time waiting, finally it's happening, and yeah, be just happy for all the people in the beginning that started the fight.
That's Leroy Lester, traditional owner, ending Oliver Gordon's report there. The Minister for Indigenous Australians is Ken Wyatt, and he joined me earlier. Ken Wyatt, welcome to AM. How significant is today?
Look, I think it's a significant point in the history of this country in terms of the traditional owners of Uluru having their say and having their wishes respected. Even though many Australians have disagreed with them, it is a sacred site.
Have you been surprised by the numbers of people rushing to the rock to climb it?
See, I've been disappointed. I understand there are people who want about to put it on their bucket list. It would be equivalent to having a rush of people climbing over the Australian War Memorial, if I can be so brazen in that regard, because our sacred objects, community by community, are absolutely important in the story and the history of that nation of people.
Late yesterday, respected academic Marcia Langton used social media to say a curse will fall on them all. She'd seen pictures of lots of people climbing the rock. She went on to say they will remember how they defiled the sacred place until they die, and history will record their contempt for Aboriginal culture. What do you think about that sentiment?
Marcia expresses often strong sentiments about elements of social justice, but the way in which disrespect occurs, and that's what has angered her. I wouldn't want to curse anybody, nor leave them with negative elements of life. Just reflect back on what you've done and reflect back on the fact that you've disrespected a community of traditional owners who've always wanted the right to have a say about what is sacred to them.
Traditional owners in other places, like the Grampians, are wanting to protect sites and have banned climbing with ropes. That ban was introduced without warning, and negotiations there have stalled. For nearly 5 months, climbers say that they haven't been able to talk with the three registered Aboriginal parties about it, and the climbers are asking for your intervention, saying that parks and state ministers have botched this. Will you consider intervening?
Actually, I haven't had that request at all. Generally on land issues that are particular to states and territories, we allow state and territory ministers to deal with it. Then if they ask for our involvement, then it's either myself or Minister Lee, predominantly Minister Lee, because she has that responsibility within her portfolio and I have the cultural responsibility. So both of us would be involved if we're invited.
Do you worry, though, if talks haven't gone anywhere in 5 months?
I think sometimes some of these elements take longer than people want. There's certainly evidence of some of the ancient artworks being damaged. I get a sense there's been some disrespectful behaviour that has not pleased the traditional owners. There needs to be respect on both sides.
Yeah. Climbers also dispute assertions that they've damaged anything. They say that we don't want to damage culture and we don't want to damage the environment.
Well, if that's their position and they get the opportunity to negotiate that with the traditional owners, then that's the pathway that should be first taken. And government interventions of a different nature can occur in different ways.
To Indigenous recognition, you've flagged developments next week. Have you and the Prime Minister agreed on the next steps?
The Prime Minister and I are often in frequent discussions. I just wanted to take him through the stages that we now have in mind. So it's consistent with what he and I clearly understand, but a way in which it involves our people across the nation.
When will you share that information?
It'll be either Tuesday or Wednesday.
Roy R.C., the chairman of the Prime Minister's Indigenous Advisory Council, has accused the government of not listening to Indigenous Australians earlier this week. He was critical of you, saying that a voice to Parliament recognised in the Constitution is the only meaningful form of recognition. Have you spoken with him?
No, I haven't. I want to go back to a point that people seem to have forgotten. In May, the Prime Minister made it very clear there would be no voice in the Constitution. Now we need to work within those parameters and look at the best options. And it doesn't matter how much people jump up and down. The Prime Minister and our government have taken a position and therefore we need to operate within those parameters.
Roy R.C. and two other Indigenous leaders wrote that letter, Megan Davis and Pat Anderson. They were crucial from the Uluru Voice of the Heart statement. If you can't get agreement on that or talk with them about that, isn't this whole process dead?
No, it's not, because there are many communities that have not been involved in this. I accept that there were 1,300 people involved. I'm not saying that the expectations of them is wrong. It's a matter of involving a structure that will reflect local community voices, regional voices, and national voices.
You're in Adelaide today to address the International Council on Archives Conference. How much is archiving part of the process of truth-telling?
Well, actually, they hold records and accounts of points in time that are absolutely critical in the way that we reflect back on those events that have happened, both those that were damaging, but equally where records show that significant gains were made. The walk-off of Wave Hill, there will be records that are detailed around those events that we can go back and reflect on. So it is important to truth-telling, and archivists have incredible state, Commonwealth and territory records within their collections, and that includes state and territory reference libraries.
Minister, thanks for talking to AM this morning.
My pleasure, Sabra.
The Minister for Indigenous Australians, Ken Wyatt. Senior federal government officials have confirmed 10,000 robo-debt notices were accidentally sent to welfare recipients when they were meant to remain on hold for review. Human Services Department bureaucrats were extensively quizzed about it during Senate estimates hearings last night and the legality of its debt recovery system, as Gavin Coote reports.
It was a batch of debt recovery notices that was meant to be on pause. But Senior Department of Human Services official Craig Storen has told Senate estimates 10,000 debt letters were accidentally sent to Centrelink recipients in April this year.
There was a manual staff error and accounts payable notices were issued for those 10,000. Within 2 days, we'd identified the error. We had re-paused all the debts.
These debts, which had been paused, had been calculated 2 years earlier as part of an early phase of the system widely referred to as robo-debt. It's a part automated process in which those receiving government benefits are sent letters asserting that they've been overpaid and have an outstanding debt. And the 10,000 letters accidentally released this year had yet to be manually checked. When quizzed by Senator Rachel Seward, Craig Storen explained they'd since been working to clear up any issues with concerned recipients.
So the 10,000 went out by accident?
Correct.
You contacted how many?
We set up a phone line to receive phone calls.
Yep.
And we received 247 phone calls.
The computer-driven process is currently the subject of a second Senate inquiry. The first in 2017 called for the whole scheme to be suspended until it's fixed. But the Department of Human Services Secretary Renee Leon was eager to point out the process isn't as automated as some might suggest.
There's human involvement at every step of the process, so these debts are not raised by robots, and that is why we do not call it robo-debt.
The scheme's also the subject of legal challenges, including a class action by veteran litigator Peter Gordon, who argues people shouldn't have to prove they've been wrongly hit with a debt notice. The government insists the program is legal, but it didn't stop Labor Senator Kimberly Kitching from further pressing department boss Renee Leon on this.
Does the department have any concerns about the lack of legal foundation for the scheme, particularly its reverse onus of proof?
So we don't accept that there's a reverse onus of proof, Senator.
So what do you
call
it?
But the questions
that you
are...
Given that robo-debt is actually called something that you have, what do you call the reverse onus of proof?
The questions that you are raising about the legal basis for the scheme are all ones that are before the court, so I don't intend to engage in a legal discussion about them.
And that's the Secretary of the Human Services Department, Renee Leon, ending Gavin Coote's report. Police suspect all 39 migrants who died inside a refrigerated truck container in the UK were Chinese nationals being smuggled into the country. Essex police are continuing to question the 25-year-old truck driver while the long process of identifying the bodies begins. It's the latest incident in a growing wave of human trafficking into the UK, and there are now warnings that Brexit will only make the job of preventing such tragedies even more difficult. Europe correspondent Linton Besser reports.
I've seen six people getting out of the back of a lorry in the same location, seen people running out of a lorry and scattering in all directions.
That's a man from near the Purfleet port, about 30 kilometres east of London, and he's one of several who claim to have seen truck containers opened and illegal migrants clamber out.
It's part of life around here now. I think everyone is used to seeing it and hearing about it.
In the early hours of Wednesday morning, ambulance paramedics were called to an industrial estate several blocks away, where they discovered the bodies of 31 men and 8 women packed inside a refrigerated container. The dead are now suspected by authorities to all be Chinese nationals. The container had come from Zeebrugge in Belgium.
It's not a passenger route. Zeebrugge is really a freight port and a container port, so you'd have customs type resources there, not immigration type resources there. So that makes it quite an attractive route for organised crime.
That's David Wood, who until 4 years ago was the head of immigration enforcement for the UK's Home Office. And he told the ABC these less busy ports are being exploited by criminal gangs.
You're never going to search every vehicle coming into Purfleet Tilbury or other ports. You're never going to search them the other end, going leaving Seabrugge. So it does require profiling, it requires intelligence, it requires a lot of work done to try and work out what's happening at these ports.
The UK's National Crime Agency has warned that it's these smaller ports with fewer personnel which pose a significant risk. David Wood says budget cuts have also played a role.
There used to be mobile resources that Border Force had. They used to have mobile teams to go around these other ports. I don't believe they've got those resources now. So these are part of the austerity cuts.
The latest figures available are from 2013, and they show 268 so-called clandestine entrants detected trying to enter the UK through British seaports. David Wood says the true figures are significantly higher.
There's probably 100,000 plus illegal migrants a year.
Vernon Coker is on the parliamentary committee set up to tackle human trafficking.
Billions of pounds worth of business. And some people say it's more lucrative for these criminals than the drugs trade.
He says the UK is facing potentially even more difficulty in tackling the problem because of Brexit.
Europol is the intelligence arm and the policing arm of the European Union. And if we leave the European Union, then we leave Europol.
Police have raided three addresses so far in Northern Ireland, where Mo Robinson, the driver of the lorry, was based. And they've also been granted an additional 24 hours to question the driver in what has become one of Britain's biggest ever murder investigations. This is Linton Besser in London for AM.
US Vice President Mike Pence has delivered a stinging critique of the Chinese government over human rights, Hong Kong, and the detention of Muslim Uyghurs. The speech comes as US-China trade negotiators continue talks tomorrow with the aim of announcing an end to the trade war at next month's APEC conference in Chile. North America correspondent Connor Duffy.
US Vice President Mike Pence's speech has already been delayed once for fear of upsetting negotiations to end the trade war. When they resume tomorrow, the Chinese side will no doubt have plenty of questions about the address, which detailed Chinese aggression abroad and suppression at home.
Millions of ethnic and religious minorities in China are struggling against the party's efforts to eradicate their religious and cultural identities. The Communist Party in China has arrested Christian pastors, banned the sale of Bibles, demolished churches, and imprisoned more than 1 million Muslim Uyghurs.
Hopes have been high that the talks will lead to a declaration at next month's APEC meeting in Chile that the trade war is over. Mr. Pence says the blame for the protracted conflict lies with Beijing.
Beijing's behavior has become even more aggressive and destabilizing. On the trade front, this past May, after months of painstaking negotiations, resulted in mutual agreement on many key matters. At the last moment, China backed away.
Mr. Pence criticised Chinese military expansion in the South China Sea. He also accused China of seeking to isolate Taiwan and expressed support for protesters in Hong Kong.
The United States will continue to urge China to show restraint, to honour its commitments and respect the people of Hong Kong. To the millions in Hong Kong who have been peacefully demonstrating to protect your rights these past months, we stand with you. We are inspired by you.
Mr. Pence was just as critical of the National Basketball Association, whose star players have had a tense relationship with this White House. He accused the league of cowardice for deleting tweets supporting the protesters.
In siding with the Chinese Communist Party and silencing free speech, the NBA is acting like a wholly owned subsidiary of that authoritarian regime. A progressive corporate culture that willfully ignores the abuse of human rights is not progressive, it is repressive.
Sportswear giant Nike also markets itself as socially progressive. It too was accused of a foul.
Nike promotes itself as a so-called social justice champion. But when it comes to Hong Kong, it prefers checking its social conscience at the door.
Mr. Pence made it clear the White House is seeking nothing less than a fundamental restructuring of its relationship with China, but stressed America does not want conflict. This is Connor Duffy in Washington for AM.
Now to the Hunter Valley, which has earned the dubious title of having some of the worst air pollution in New South Wales. State governments for the first time held a drop-in information session in the Upper Hunter for residents to discuss their concerns ahead of what's expected to be a long, dry summer. But some remain unconvinced about the government's efforts to rein in pollution from the mining industry that employs thousands of people. Eliza Getzey has this report.
In the heart of coal mining country in the New South Wales Upper Hunter, it's not uncommon for residents to wake up to a brown haze.
That's unbelievable, the dust.
It's absolutely shocking.
We can't live with it anymore.
So keeping an eye on air quality alerts from the Office of Environment and Heritage is a daily ritual. Alan Leslie keeps count.
We had 56 in October. And you look at where the big numbers are. The big numbers are Camberwell, Mason Dew and Mount Thorley.
Life comes with a coating of brown dust, as Muswellbrook resident Cole will tell you.
We sort of go out the back for a cup of coffee or something after lunch of a day, and my wife's got to clean all the outdoor furniture. Our pool's just black because I give up cleaning it. I said, it's a waste of time cleaning it.
For Janice Lee, it's suffocating.
When I'm in town, I've got to use my puffer, and if I go to Sydney or the beaches or anywhere else, I'm fine. We love this town, but we don't want our children subjected to all this dust from the mines.
Community concern about air quality has lingered for years.
So we're holding a community event to give the community a chance to come and talk to EPA staff and scientists about air quality in this region. And it's been a really good turnout.
Adam Gilligan is the EPA's regional director for the state's north. He's running this first drop-in information session for the public.
Obviously, we can't control the drought, we can't control the bushfires, but we can control the contribution from man-made sources. And that's why we've got officers out in the field on days like today to make sure mines are doing the right thing.
2019 is already the worst year for air pollution in the Upper Hunter since monitoring began in 2010. And many residents blame the 20 or so coal mines in the region, creeping ever closer to local townships.
You can see it rising. I can hear the trucks at night. It's right on top of our town.
And there's little confidence that the authorities will act against mines that breach regulatory requirements.
Pathetic. Best they can do is they give them a warning letter, then they have a prosecution, and maybe they'll get fined $15,000. They'd spend more than that on morning tea.
Adam Gilligan from the EPA insists breaches are followed up.
What we tend to see is that mining companies and industry more broadly do take receiving penalty notices and regulatory action from us very seriously. It's not something that they want to have to report to their boards, particularly, you know, multinational companies and so forth.
But some Muswellbrook residents, like Cole, are almost ready to admit defeat.
Oh, yeah, we've been going to leave for ages, but we wouldn't get the money for our house. We'd lose $100,000 on our house, most probably. And to relocate to a place like Maitland and that, we want $100,000 more, really, to buy a house down there. That don't look like that'll happen.
That's Muswellbrook resident Cole ending that report by Eliza Getzey. Do you know if your measles vaccinations are up to date? Australia's chief medical officer is urging everyone to check their records and to make sure you get a jab if you're unsure about it, or get one if you haven't. It comes as Western Australia is grappling to control the worst outbreak of the contagious disease in 5 years. Bridget Fitzgerald prepared this report.
Okay, so we've got Pilbara Public Health Unit there. Hi, everyone. We're just trying to hook in MCDC and then we'll kick off.
In a conference room at the West Australian Health Department in Perth, Dr. Paul Armstrong chairs a statewide meeting to discuss the latest measles outbreak.
So we have a newly confirmed case today. So
Western Australia has had 51 measles cases this year, 27 confirmed in the past month alone.
Every moment that they're infectious, we check on where they've been.
Dr. Ben Scully is WA's head of Metropolitan Communicable Disease Control. For every confirmed case, health authorities will need to speak to at least 100 more people who may have been exposed.
We would be checking on, you know, what workplace they work in, what train they caught, what bus they caught, where they drove their car, who's in their house, who's visited the house, the pizza delivery person, really quite a degree of detail to try and capture every single person they've been in contact with.
Treatment is possible up to 72 hours after exposure, but health authorities say the best protection is always a vaccine.
Measles is one of the most infectious viruses we know. It's almost certain you'll get it if you're not immune and you're exposed to someone.
Professor Brendan Murphy is Australia's chief medical officer. The number of measles cases nationwide is now more than 230, a five-year high.
The problem is caused by this international trend, which in itself is probably related to some fall in vaccination rates and our continual need to keep vaccination up in this country.
It's why he keeps calling measles the canary in the coal mine.
It points out those areas of our community where there might be low uptake of childhood immunisation, because half of these 235 cases are in younger people, and some of those it's because they've just not had the properly provided childhood immunisation.
WA's latest measles outbreak is believed to have started with a man visiting from New Zealand. And it's international travel that's also putting some Australians at risk. Busselton man Zach Charlesworth contracted the disease during a visit to Singapore in July. He became ill 12 days after he got home.
I started basically continually throwing up, couldn't even keep water down. Then my condition just got worse and they ended up having to transfer me to intensive care, and then I spent 5 days in isolation ward.
The 38-year-old had no idea he'd never been vaccinated. Now recovered, he's urging other Australians to check their records.
A small injection is so much better than what I went through in intensive care, just over a silly thing like measles that is totally preventable with a shot.
That's former measles patient Zach Charlesworth, ending Bridget Fitzgerald's report. We often hear concerns about shrinking koala populations in large parts of Australia, but in some areas their numbers have exploded, causing overpopulation and horrible cases of starvation. One method to alleviate their suffering is to move them, but is relocation in the animals' best interests? New study near the Great Ocean Road in Victoria has found it's giving one group of vulnerable koalas a new lease on life. David Sparks reports.
For tourists at Cape Otway in southwest Victoria, koalas are one of the main attractions. On this stretch of the Great Ocean Road, tour operator Mark Kinnenmonth says plenty of international visitors managed to spot a koala nestled on the branches of a tree.
Oh, just blown away that they've actually sighted one in the wild. Some of them have seen them in a zoo or sort of a wildlife place. It's an animal they want to tick off their list. It's coming to Australia. Pretty keen to get a photo.
But koalas in parts of Cape Otway have had their problems. In some areas, their favourite food, the manna gum tree, was so abundant their numbers soared, climbing so high that many of the trees were stripped of their foliage and started to die. Researcher Desley Wisson from Deakin University says the koalas began starving.
Government responded with welfare checks of the population and euthanasing any animals in really poor condition. But that in itself doesn't solve the problem.
She says koalas couldn't control their own population numbers to match the amount of food available.
Leave it alone and the population will increase again. So we decided that we needed to implement a management strategy that involved both fertility control and translocation of some individuals to try to bring that population down to a sustainable density.
So a Victorian government trial moved 36 koalas from the Cape Otway area, relocating them 90 kilometres east to an area near Aries Inlet.
We really didn't have much idea as to whether translocated koalas would survive that process.
The transferred koalas were monitored, along with 24 that hadn't been moved.
The ones that we moved actually ended up doing a lot better than the ones that stayed behind. So they improved in their body condition, their body mass increased. You know, survival of that group was the same as survival of the ones that stay behind. So our conclusion there was that translocation is actually a good option for these koalas.
Desley Wisson and fellow researcher Emily Hines from EcoPlan Australia believe the successful relocation trial should be replicated with more koalas.
It's been happening since the 1920s, having high density of koalas that have needed to be managed by the government. The koalas are already existing there in a human-affected environment, so there is sort of agricultural land and then, you know, patches of koala trees. Yeah, and these koalas had been introduced there from French Island, but it is still, you know, part of their natural range.
It is something we have a responsibility for as humans, and it's not just purely natural.
Yeah, definitely.
That's Emily Hines from EcoPlan Australia, speaking there with reporter David Sparks. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. The thoroughbred racing industry is being forced to answer a lot of uncomfortable questions about footage of horses being shocked, kicked and beaten on their way to slaughter.
Hundreds of horses are being killed every week. So today we speak to the owner of a Melbourne Cup champion about the moral reckoning in racing.
That's The Signal. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.